And our guest tonight, Dr. Chet Snow, Mass Dreams of the Future. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Chet, let's talk a little bit about the book, Mass Dreams of the Future. First of all, of course, the title, what does that mean?
Basically, Mass Dreams of the Future, these are programmed dreams. They're not spontaneous dreams. But the concept was Dr. Helen Wambach, who was my mentor back in the 1980s and who wrote really the first research books on reincarnation, by taking groups of people in workshops in a controlled setting into their past lives, into time periods of past lives, not just sort of uncontrolled. In other words, she would suggest to them, now you can go back and get a picture of what, you know, like 1880 was, or 1850, mm-hmm. something that would be beyond their life experience. And in this work, she decided that she wanted to see what would happen if she took like a Gallup poll. That's all you can really liken it to. It's like a Gallup poll of the unconscious of our culture about the future. She quickly found that if you tried to take people too close into their current life expectancy, many of them wouldn't go there. There's a kind of a blockage, a mental block that maybe is a protection thing, I don't know. She used to say the liver wants to live, meaning that we don't want to see our own demise physically while we're still in this body. It's not something that's very pleasant to go through. But if you take people ahead of that life expectancy, like 150 years from now or 350 years from now, and ask them what they experience, why then you get a much higher percentage of people that are able to do that. So that's kind of the basis of the whole book. I started it with Helen, and then she passed away very suddenly of a heart attack, leaving me with really lots of notes and many research sessions done, but no manuscript. We kind of had an outline, but that was about all. So I went and did some more work overseas. I decided that I wanted to take it to another culture. The one I'm most familiar with is France, because I grew up speaking French as well as English. Just in my household, that was a common, you know, my mother was of French origin, and her family spoke French. She was educated in France. So although I was born in America and, you know, until I was 20 years old, lived always in the United States, nonetheless, I did speak that language. So I went over there and just applied the same techniques to groups over there and found that, amazingly, about the same percentages applied in terms of the future work. I really couldn't find any great differences in what people came up with. And later I went to England and did some work there. I went to South America and did some work down there in Spanish. We didn't go to China or Japan or anything really like far out, but I had other researchers working in the United States, in Canada, England, France, and South America. So I felt that we got a very interesting look at Western culture's concept of the future from this. As I say, we had a group protocol that we would take people into a very light trance state, mm-hmm. offering them a suggestion that they would go forward and see if they were alive or if they experienced life in a body in certain time periods, one of which was around 2150, another of which was about 2350, 2400. We actually did a third one further ahead than that, but I didn't put it in the book because the reports were so unqualifiable, and many people came back saying, well, I can't really talk about it. There are no words to describe it or to discuss it. So I used the two time periods, as I say, 2150, 2350. And then because I thought it would be a more compelling story, I added my own progressions into the near future, into the 1990s and 2000 time period, and then actually into the about 2100 time period at the very end of the book, into what at that time seemed to be my next incarnation, you might call it.
Would this be time traveling, Chet?
Yes, it is. Of course, I think it's really the main kind of time travel, because it's travel through the mind. Time is only a human construct, after all, right? And it's based on our sun, our planet's revolution around our sun. We may, by the way, just as an aside, come into a real difficulty if suddenly our planet and our sun don't have the same relationship that they do today, which could happen.
That's
it
true.
Could. I mean, I'm not saying it will. I'm saying it could. You know the research that's been now done that is showing that really our solar system is not part of the Milky Way. It is becoming part of the Milky Way. It is being gobbled up by the Milky Way. And we are in a collision course with the Milky Way, which is fascinating and comes back to the Mayan stuff, which we can get into later if you want. Because I think one of the things is the Mayans knew that. And that great dark rift that they saw in the center of the Milky Way, they called the serpent, the cosmic serpent, is actually the place where the two galaxies are coming together. So in terms of people's future predictions, I think that what is so unique about my book, Mass Dreams of the Future, is that as far as I know, it's the only time someone, a group of people, because ultimately, as I say, we had three or four people doing the research in different parts of the United States and around the world, that was to get away from it just being only, you know, a bias of one person. Because subconsciously, you can affect people when they're in a trance state. There's no doubt about that. That's how healing occurs. The gifted healers entrain other people into the positive energy of healing. It also is how curses work in medicine societies around the world where people, you know, have a belief system that incorporates that you can be cursed. And a lot of people in the West do, too. They just don't talk about it, by the way. And anyway, I think that what's unique, though, in the book is that it was the first time I know of that people were taken in a group experiment, and then the results were tallied statistically and looked at dispassionately and sorted out essentially by environment.
Okay, and this was done about, what, 20 years ago?
Yeah, the book was published actually when Bush Sr. was president.
All right, gosh.
So an interesting time, huh?
Yeah, sure.
It's like a deja vu a little bit. So we have a couple of different things. There's some philosophical chapters that I wrote because I felt it needed some glue for people to understand. I have a chapter called Hunting for the Future, an Ancient Tradition, where I try to discuss what different societies, including our own, have the value they have put on future prediction or not. And in different parts of the world, that has been very uneven and unequal over time. Interestingly enough, one of the societies who's put a great deal of value on future predicting and past and future bringing them together has been the Hopi Nation right here in Arizona. And so I talked about some of the prophecies of the Hopi in the book, and that led later after the book was published to one of their people reading it and getting in touch with me, interestingly enough, to help me learn more about their prophecy. And through, again, one of these strange synchronicities, ended up in the house that my wife and I live in, actually was the home of a Hopi elder at one time.
What's your take on Hopi prophecy?
Well, I think they have one of the oldest unbroken spiritual traditions of the world. I think there are very few of their people left who really seriously understand it and who live it and who believe it, or you know, even though it's a cultural part of their identity. But that's part of their prophecy, that it would come down to a very limited number of people who would be able to, I believe the word that they use is like singing, keep a vibration, in other words, a resonance going that would maintain a balance in the world. And according to them, that the number is dropping so radically right now that we are losing that balance, and they and other native peoples, aboriginals and other peoples around the world, how can I say it? They're losing ground. One of the reasons we brought the elders together in Sedona, which is a power center and a sacred site, and vibrations are stronger when they come out of a sacred site. That's just kind of like going in a cathedral. Your prayer somehow gets amplified, like working with the crystal skull, because of all the people that have been there doing it before. So the same thing is in a place like Sedona, where energy gets transmitted through the earth more powerfully. All of these traditions around the world of these indigenous peoples are saying we're losing ground to the, in a sense, the rape of our civilization by Western culture and Western pop culture, which is powerful and attracts the young while killing them. at the same time.
Yeah. They're all saying this, though, like
they
you
are.
Say.
They are, and I think they're right. And we see the world swinging wilder and wilder out of balance, and we put all kinds of labels on it. But perhaps, and this I would just throw out, one of the real reasons is that we are losing the spiritual underpinning. That's why I talk about a global spiritual awakening in the book. We are losing the spiritual underpinning that these ancient peoples who have a tradition of keeping going energy and vibration and resonance through, you know, conscious prayer, chanting, mantraing, singing to the elements. And we're losing that. So and the Hopi are part of that, unfortunately, because it's really very sad to go to their lands today. It is like going to a third world country in the United States. I don't know if you've ever been there, but I've been there many times. And
not as many times as you have.
I love the people. They're wonderful. They're some of the most generous, loving, giving, peaceful people that I've ever met. And yet, as they say, with tears in their eyes, we're losing ground to McDonald's, Coca-Cola, the Chevrolet.
Well, but how accurate? How accurate do you think their prophecies could be compared to others? And again,
I think their prophecy is pretty accurate. You have to understand it's a spiritual prophecy, so not everything is going to be in black and white, and they're not going to say. They're not going to give you a prediction as that the stock market is going to, you know, fall apart tomorrow.
No, but it's apocalyptic.
It is apocalyptic because it is birthing. They say that you have to go through a birth canal, which is a difficult process and a painful process to be born into something new. And they say that we are at the point of birth pangs of a new reality, of a new world. And one of the motor forces behind that, one of the things that will bring that about is, frankly, because the vibration will not be held by the current civilization strongly enough to keep natural forces in order, in balance, operating harmoniously. Edgar Cayce, who's obviously not a Hopi, but he was an important psychic in his time, made a very clear prediction that our collective thoughts influence even the sun. Influence even the solar flares, and the more that there are wars and disharmony and dissonance among human beings in large groups on the Earth, the more solar activity and flares and negative consequences we can expect even from the sun. Well, the Hopi have similar, you know, sayings in their prophecy, but their prophecy ultimately is one of hope because they say it's regeneration, it's birth. It's not death, it's about birth.
Well,
it may look like birth. It looks like death.
That's what I mean.
I expect that all of us as fetuses didn't want to leave the womb. I mean,
all right.
That's probably a very, very difficult process to go through, and suddenly you're thrust into a cold, difficult environment where you're slapped around and you have to start to breathe instead of get your nutrients automatically through the mother and your blood system. You have to open your eyes to a light that is very strong and powerful that you're not prepared for. All of these things sound very negative from that fetus's point of view, and yet from our human point of view, we say, well, but if you don't go through that, you never learn to live.
In your book, Mass Dreams, you talk about four types of future societies.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about
sure.
that.
Based on environment. That was the key term. There was a part, one of the questions, and they were kept very simple because the subconscious mind doesn't deal in a lot of rationalization and logic. It's a simple process. One of the things was you look around and what kind of a place are you in? And so based on that, I was able to see that there were really just four, and I was amazed in all the cases we did, and there's 1,000 or more cases in this, that four environments kept coming up again and again and again and again at one of the four. The first one, I call them the spacefarers, or people who are not on the Earth, because when they looked around them, they saw a habitat and environment that was clearly not terrestrial. Either they were on a space platform, a space station, in a spaceship. Some mm-hmm. of them were on moon colonies. Some of them ultimately were on other planets if you went far enough into the future. Most of the ones in 150 years from now were on some kind of colony or space station or something around the solar system. Then the second one, which was, interestingly enough, the smallest group, I think only about 15%, I call them the New Age Creative Communities, because when they looked around, they found a beautiful environment, and they noted very clearly that they were in some kind of community, that there was almost like they were consciously using a collective thought form, and that collective thought form was somehow creating the environment around them. It's interesting, huh? Like both islands of positive consciousness in what might be beyond that, not so nice.
But they were on this planet.
They were, yeah. 2, 3, and 4 were on the Earth.
Okay.
That's very clear. Only type 1, that was one type, and that was about 30%, 25-30% of the whole sample. The smallest group were, as I say, the New Age creative type community. The third group, which was the majority, the largest group, maybe it was only 45-50%, were, I call them high-tech, because either they were living in some kind of underground or underdome or protected environment, but very, very high-tech. All of it was high-tech. They talked about, you know, being in some sort of jumpsuit, silvery kind of materials. A lot of the things you might have seen in Flash Gordon or other comics. You know, these things do influence our subconscious's view of the future. Remember, that's what we're looking at. We're looking at a Gallup poll of the subconscious's view of the future of humanity. And so they were talking about this high-tech environment and the domes, and then if I asked them to go outside, and some groups were asked that question, well, it was very difficult to go outside, or they had to have a breathing apparatus, so they didn't go outside. Some people just said, well, we never go outside.
And what year were they talking about?
These four types came up in the 2150 environment time, so about 150 years from now.
So, and time frame all around the same time period then?
That was what was asked.
For these groups, okay.
And then they were asked to go ahead another 250 years beyond that, you see. So we got two reports from many of the people. Not all of them found that they had a lifetime in one of those two times. I mean, there was a certain percentage who simply came back with nothing. Some of them didn't go anywhere. Some of them, as I say, went to other time periods. Some of them, interestingly enough, actually went back into the past, but a very few people did that. But the third group then, like I say, was this high-tech, very different than the second group, somewhat similar to the first in that they, some of them said that, yes, we have spaceships that come and go from our, you know, our domes, our cities. Then the fourth group were, I call them the rustics, because if you didn't know better, you would have thought that they were living in the past, because they describe a rustic kind of civilization a la a 1900 type of thing, with horses and maybe electricity, but nothing much more than that. Certainly nothing like we have today.
Almost as if civilization regressed a little bit.
Exactly. There was apparently a part of civilization or a point of civilization regressed. And then when I asked them where they were geographically, they were always in what are today kind of outposts of civilization anyway. Places like Africa or Australia or, you know, kind of Mongolia, Canada, South America, places that you know, I'm not saying there aren't westernized civilization and high-tech places in those things today, but they're not the center of it. You understand what I mean?
Chet, did any of them see physical change, let's say, to North America, like Edgar Cayce did and some others?
Well, you have to really ask very unusual questions to get that kind of answer from people. You almost have to kind of take them up in a spaceship and have them look back down. So that wasn't something that we could really do very easily. But yes, they talked about climate change just by their geographical situation. I had a number of people in these primitive rustic communities in Canada, but they were living in a Canada of a much warmer climate. And there were a number of people in Siberia and Upper Mongolia, China area that were also much warmer climate than it would be today. So it was almost like, conversely speaking, there were people in Africa or other parts of where should be very hot climate. They were talking colder, temperate climate.
Well, and what's amazing is this was done 20 years ago. We'll be back. We'll talk more about this. Mass Dreams of the Future. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Okay, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with Chet, some incredible information. We go back to the future on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Chet Snow, our special guest. I think this is incredible, Chet, that this was done 20 years ago, and it appears that some of the things that they have predicted into the future, even though we're talking about 2100-plus in terms of time period, it's kind of strange that it's echoing some of the things that are happening now.
Well, you might think of it like a plant with seeds. We're in the seed phase of these things, so naturally the seed contains all of the, the potential of the ultimate plant. It doesn't surprise me entirely that we're seeing certain things. It would be surprising if we weren't seeing any of it. 150 years isn't all that far from now, ultimately, actually, when you think about it. I think that this book was really published before its time, in a way. And we're just now getting to the point where people are perhaps understanding some of the imbalance that is being created. And one of the predictions, even in the near-term future part, my own story in the beginning, which you might have seen some of, where the timing, the dating is not exactly right. I talk about things in the 1990s that are just now occurring in the 10 years later, 12 years later, in the 2000 period. I'm not too concerned about that. I learned a long time ago, and Edgar Cayce talked about that, and all the prophets have talked about that, that linear timing is always the most difficult thing to get right. It's usually sequencing that's important. Again, it's more organic. It's like the seed grows into a seedling, a sapling, and ultimately a tree. So it's a sequence of events that takes place. But a couple of just the anecdotal things. One thing you'd never have thought back in 1985 or 86 when I was just first starting to get into this, that 25 years later in 2007, 2008, people would actually spend time looking at a television for watching the weather, sometimes right. For significant time periods.
Just sitting there watching.
Just sitting there watching the weather, yeah. I mean, that just didn't happen. You heard the weather was a five-minute segment on the nightly news, you know, with kind of a strange guy in a crew cut and glasses. And yet that was what our people saw, and that is what I saw in the future environment. Another one that is a little more kind of woo-woo or strange to me is I remember so clearly seeing this president, and I didn't even know that the first President Bush had any children, to be honest with you. I was not very political in my life. And yet I saw this president that had these big ears, and people would comment on his strange head and looking ears, almost like Alfred E. Newman out of Mad Comics. Guess who we have in the White House?
He does have that look.
I mean, I've seen cartoon characterizations that way. And well, the first time I saw one, I thought, oh my God, that's what I was seeing all that time ago and that progression experience. I don't know. There are other parts of it that didn't come true. We've certainly, in some ways, improved our world, although we've created more dangers along with the improvements. We haven't been faced with a nuclear standoff, you know, the way we were back in the 50s and 60s.
Did anyone 20 years ago see any kind of nuclear problem in the future?
Yes, they did. Terribly and, you know, badly enough, of course, where they saw it was in the Middle East. And they saw at least one more set of bombs before humanity comes to its senses and totally, you know, wipes them off the face of the earth. That really scourge. And actually, if you had people who had the abduction ET contacts, you know very well that the one thing that almost universally the ET, friendly ETs anyway, say to us is that you are children playing with matches and these will go boom in your face, this atomic, use of the atom bomb, exploding the atom, that it's really the wrong way to go.
But they did see that. And do we know what year it might have occurred?
No, no. Timing again. It's a sequential kind of thing.
But obviously before their 2100, 2150 time period.
Yes, that's true. Absolutely so. And again, as I say, coming, it really seemed to be focused on what we call the Middle East part of the world, and possibly New York. Those were the two places that came up. Not very many places, thank God.
Well,
it's not all doom and gloom.
It doesn't take many. Well, it is if you live in New York.
Did come up.
Well.
And you know that, I guess, right now, it's been in the news just yesterday and the day before that the 5th of September, we almost sent bombs to the Middle East. I don't know how many of your listeners are aware of that, but it is out there on the news.
How many people participated in this?
Altogether, somewhere close to 1,000.
1,000 people.
Yeah.
So what would you say, I mean, can you predict the accuracy rate on this?
Oh, wow. It's a Gallup poll of our unconscious view of the future. And as I said at the beginning of the show, I think one of the most important things that I've learned out of it is that, like any prophecy, when you put it down, the fact of studying it and then publishing it and having people read it begins to change the future that is predicted. And hopefully in a positive way, because people have then free will to realize what they're being shown, and then have the opportunity, after all, to do something about it, because it is still the future, and we have the power of decision in the now. That's what I think people need to learn. I'm very hopeful about the future in that respect. I do see it as a birth process. I do see it. And we have the ability to breathe and dream into being something positive instead of something negative. There are some hurdles that we still have to get over. One of them is the nuclear bomb problem. There's such a huge stockpile out there. Some positive use has to be found for all that material and that energy. And otherwise people will continue just, you know, like with drugs, to use it in a negative way.
Can any of the things that they predicted, Chet, can they be changed and altered?
Yes. I firmly believe it. I've seen that in my own life. My own story was that by this time, you know, I would have been in, there would have been much more disaster taking place around the planet, and I would be living on some isolated ranch somewhere with just a few people, and it wasn't a very pleasant future. When I went through it, I remember it was, they were the most unpleasant futures or therapy sessions research sessions, I guess ultimately they were, with Dr. Wambach, research sessions that I ever did. Some days when I would come out of them, I would not be very happy. But I realized afterward in publishing the book that was a springboard from which I could use that material that I had come up out of my own unconscious mind, that I certainly wasn't thinking about it before the session started, and use that material to do something positive with it. And so I feel that I have. I really changed my life significantly. I know I wouldn't be the same person if I hadn't gone through those sessions. And that's one reason I do some progression therapy with people. There is a therapeutic use for this. If you, for an individual, seeing a future that may not be appealing, you can go back and look for the seeds, the roots of where that came from, and in those behavior patterns, you can start to change them today. Because
the fact
you can change something.
All right, the fact, though, that some of them who looked into the future saw some kind of nuclear calamity, does that tell you that we didn't change it? We didn't change the future because the future is that something happened.
No, it says that is the think of it as like a baseball player throwing a fastball or a curveball. His intention or her intention is to throw the ball in a certain way that will go across the plate to get a strike but elude the bat and the eye of the batter, right?
Right.
So that's
the goal.
That's the intention. And that's when they launch, and the future that is seen by the pitcher is of that ball going across in that way. Now, that doesn't always happen, does it? It does with a good pitcher more often than not. So there is a blueprint of that occurring, and it is that psychic blueprint that people's unconscious hook up with and that came out in this book, I believe. But it is just that. It is a blueprint. It is not hard and fast. It is what will happen if nothing is done about it, if no one wakes up. As people wake up, and more people wake up, hopefully, and begin to say, well, that's not the future that I want, this nuclear explosion, even if there's only one. Let's just put it down to one. I mean, I think there were two or three seen in the book. But even if there's only one, and say, that is not the future that I want, and so I will start today to focus part of my energy and my mind, my mental ability, to say, that is not the future that I want. I will find a way just right here and now in my life to change that. And the first thing you do might be to contact someone that you know and that you had an argument with and forgive them. Or it might be to repay somebody some money you owed them, that you know you owed them and that you didn't pay them back because you didn't have to, or that they had forgotten about. Or it might be to go out and do some, as it's called, act of senseless creative beauty. In other words, create an alternative reality in your life, and as you start to do that in your life, little groups of people will start to do it in their lives, and then that will impact bigger groups of people, and ultimately it reaches the top. It's not a trickle-down. It doesn't start from the top, George. I truly don't believe that. I think it starts from the bottom, from the normal, ordinary guys and gals, and works its way toward the top. The top will be the most resistant to change, by the way.
Well, that's true. Now, how does all this tie into the Mayan calendar 2012 date?
Well, I think that the Mayans had a tremendous predictive system. It may well be that they had intuitive perception. They obviously had a great mathematical model of reality, physical 3D reality. They, I do believe, knew that our planet was not really, and our solar system not really of the Milky Way, and that we are becoming part of the Milky Way, but that there is an influence from the Milky Way. Just as other indigenous peoples, they know about what we're learning in quantum physics about vibration and about resonance. And they know that if you can create a vibration that goes to a higher octave or a higher position, a higher positioning, you can, in effect, move your reality toward that. Thoughts create things. Edgar Cayce said, mind is ever the builder. So it's when you see that, their calendar said, we're going to come to a certain place in which floodgates of energy are going to be opened. And that is 2012 or 2011. You can, you know, get the date that you feel it works for you. I know there's several systems out there, and I don't like to get into that debate. That's just not my debate. But Not that it's not a good debate. Let people debate it, but it's not mine. Mine is to say that it's there. We're going to come towards something, and it's not an ending point. It is a changeover point. And something, because of the energy of the two galaxies merging through this dark rift, this dark matter, mass, this dark place in the Milky Way, along the ecliptic of the Milky Way, we will suddenly be subjected mentally and physically to energy rays that have we've not been, perhaps for 12,000, maybe 24,000, 26,000 years.
So you believe it'll be a celestial event as well?
I do believe it will be a celestial event. I'm not sure it's going to be one that's going to be so visible. You know, one of the most important things that's happening right now is this whole thing that we're finding out. You're familiar with Andrew Collins. Have you ever had Andrew on your show?
I don't believe I've had him directly.
Okay, you know of his work from England. And how he has shown that much of the ancient world was aligned to the Cygnus constellation, which, interestingly enough, is where C. SETI decided, you know, to send the radio wave signals back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
People don't put those two together very often, but that is the case. Carl Sagan obviously knew that about ancient civilizations being corresponding to Cygnus, because he decided that was the place to send stuff to. Somehow, we are being bombarded with high-frequency gamma radiation that comes through in bursts. And again, as our electromagnetic field around the Earth is going down, we're going to get more of that coming into us. And that does affect us, apparently. And it has affected us in the past, and it will in the future. So there is a recurring aspect to this, is what I would say. And the Mayans knew that. That's how they knew that their calendar wasn't coming to an end. We always like to think of doomsday and it's the end of stuff. That's not true. It's not the end of things. It is a changeover. And then we go, just think of a piano octave. You go up, C, A, B, C, D, and then C, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. You end up with do again, which is just an octave higher. It's the same kind of thing.
How important was Helen Wambach to your work before she,
Oh, well, I mean, Helen, the Mass Dreams of the Future was based on her concept originally. She really was the person who set that up. I came to her originally as a patient. I didn't realize what was happening in my life. I had some things that were very strong with psychic.
I did have Andrew on.
I'm sorry?
I did have Andrew on about 6 months ago.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Yeah, well, right. So you know his work is so important. That's one reason we're bringing him to Arizona in November, because we think it's so important people need to hear this. They need to hear this message, because for me it's a message of hope that we're going to, not to the end of something, but to the beginning of something, and that there is something that is so potentially greater that it's even hard for us to imagine it, so that we only see the negative side, we don't see the positive side. But going back to Helen, I had gone through a number of psychic awakenings at that time in my life, back in the early 80s, at the time of my grandmother's passing, my grandmother's death. She was very close to me, and I had lost my parents when I was a much younger person, only 20-some years old, through various... My mother had cancer, my father died in what could only be construed as a medical snafu. One of those things where he went into routine surgery and basically they killed him. I can laugh now, but it didn't seem that way at the time.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's not a laughter of happiness. I understand.
Anyway, when my grandmother passed, it was a different thing. And oddly, very strangely to me, she came back to me and she started to tell me that my view of things in the world was too limited and I didn't understand it. I didn't know what I was talking about. And this was very powerful in my life. And that is how I met Helen Wambach, because my grandmother from the other side basically came one time she would come in and appear to me right in the room when I was alone and talk to me. And she said, I have things to do. This was after some time that we had these conversations. I have other things to do, and I'm going to turn you over to a woman named Helen from Berkeley that you'll meet soon. And 3 days later, I was in a meeting, and somebody talked about Helen Wambach, who did regressions, and she was from Berkeley. Well, it was like, duh. I guess I didn't have to be hit over the head harder than that. I guess I've always had knowledge since that time that, sort of like a near-death experience, even though it wasn't a near-death for me, there's a guidance going there. And when I got in touch with Helen, it was very clear to both of us that we had worked together on the other side before. And that I had agreed to come, and she must have known, because she was ill, that she wasn't going to stay in her body very long, that somebody needed to complete this, because she wanted this work to be there for humanity to refer to, of these progressions and looking at the way people had looked at time and the future from other cultures in the past. So that's what it was. It was meant to be. It was set up. And then, as I say, I know it changed my life. If I've had any influence, one of the things I've tried to do in the last 10, 12 years has been to reach out to other people and bring people together who, again, would go back to their own communities and start to change things where they are.
Well, let's bring people together when we come back, Chet. We'll take phone calls for the entire hour in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.